superior news and issues from a superior point of view.
Hello everyone, I'm Barbara Riles.
She came into your living room for years as one of the Twin Ports' best known TV news anchors.
I sat down at the keyboard, started with a basic premise, and then the story just sort of came out of my fingers.
Now, meet Barbara Riles, the novelist. But first, last fall, he flipped the long-held Democratic state Senate seat Republican.
And so the fact that all parties are having this discussion is a really good sign, and we're in a spot where we haven't been before. And so I'm pretty hopeful.
State Senator Romaine Quinn updates us on what may be a fortuitous year legislatively for Northwest Wisconsin. Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. For years, the congressional and state legislative delegations in Northwest Wisconsin were solidly the domain of Democrats, a trend that began to change with the retirement of longtime 7th District Congressman Dave Obey in 2011. He was succeeded by a Republican, and last fall, the area's state legislative delegation followed suit with the election of State Representatives Angie Sapik and Chance Green and State Senator Romaine Quinn. Quinn is no stranger to politics. In fact, he was almost born into them, I'd say, at 19 becoming the youngest person ever elected as mayor of Rice Lake. He later served 3 terms in the assembly representing the 75th district from 2015 to 2021. He's a graduate of the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire and worked for the local Coca-Cola bottler. He and his wife Raquel have 2 young sons, the youngest just born in December. They live outside of the town of Cameron, and he joins me now. Welcome to Simply Superior, Romaine Quinn.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, I got to ask about the newborn. Keeping you up, or is that a good reason to run to the Capitol?
Yeah, it's a little busier for my wife than me. That tends to happen to the mothers. But yes, they're both keeping us on our toes.
Has she ever said, take him with you?
Maybe the oldest.
That's got to be fun, too. And how old is the oldest?
Romaine is 2 years old.
Romaine, you know, you walked into my next question. In your campaign, you were the one with the funny commercials, I'd say the funniest. And you were making fun of your name and I guess your son's name, too. So where did you get the name Romaine?
Yeah, well, it is a family name. My grandfather was named Romaine, and my dad and myself, and now my son. A lot of people ask me, you know, what ethnicity is it? I said, my last name's Quinn, which is Irish, so Romaine has nothing to do with that. It was just a family name that started long before I was around, and we've chosen to keep it.
And so you said your grandfather, your father, yourself, and your son. Do you have numbers after that? Is he the fourth, or do you do different middle names, or...?
We all have different middle names, so technically not the third, fourth, senior or junior.
All right. And I have to follow on your own joke, although it's not self-deprecating if somebody else makes it, but do you have other lettuce varieties for your middle names?
Yes, lots of varieties. Don't worry, I've heard them all over the years. So I'll give you $10 if you can come up with a joke I haven't heard yet.
Good point. And by the way, as someone named Robin, I'll tell you, I don't need to hear about Batman or birds or whatever. I've heard them all before.
You're in the same boat.
Right. Well, we just had the Superior Days delegation at the Capitol last month, and even though it came during the biggest snowstorm of the year, it seems to do that, everyone did feel good about it. People weren't shy about noting that we now have a Republican legislative delegation, as I mentioned, with your party in power, meaning you should be able to bring local concerns to the people who can get them on the agenda. So is that pretty much a lay of the land of what's going to happen?
Yeah, no, I'm glad that everyone was still able to make it down. I actually got my start in politics quite young, but in high school, I was actually a Superior Days delegate when the Rice Lake area used to be a part of it. So that's kind of when I got to go to the Capitol first and get my feet wet, and it snowballed ever since. So very familiar, and Superior Days holds a special place for me. So I thought it was a great opportunity for the residents to make that trip down. I know I think it was their 38th year to really get in front of people. I think is more impactful than just sending an email or a letter or a phone call about issues. And when you were absolutely right in terms of, can we get something done? That was exactly what I pitched on the campaign trail, is that I served with Senator Buley as well, but I felt there was either a lack of leadership or an inability to get something done in the Senate. And so that was my argument to folks. We may not agree on everything, but right now you're getting nothing. And so if we can have someone at the table in the room where the decisions are being made, I think that's going to be a big benefit to our area, and I'm looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Janet Beverly, for those a little confused about the local politics, is your predecessor, who is a longtime Democrat in the seat. So let's get specific on it. The big one that Superior and other municipalities and the counties have been seeking for years, and actually they've been led by a Republican, or Republican-leading business people, is tax retention, which would allow counties and municipalities to keep 20% of the sales tax that they collect. Is this the year for it?
So that issue has taken a number of forms over the years, but the concept has been the same, is that we don't have the revenue we need to maintain the infrastructure or services we have. And so how do we get more of that? So in the past, there was the discussion about another 0.5% sales tax that would only go to infrastructure, not other services. I was a supporter of that in the assembly. Unfortunately, we couldn't get it past the Senate. And now the proposal has came back in a little bit different form, but similar in terms of now, instead of just doing a 0.5%, we'll dedicate 20% of the overall sales tax and invest that back into our local communities while changing the way we do shared revenue. So that would go away, and funding going forward would be based on new formulas that are developed by the Township Association, the Counties Association, and the League of Municipalities, to make sure it actually makes sense for counties. We know there is a huge disparity in funding right now. There are some townships that get 27 cents per person in shared revenue, while Milwaukee City and Milwaukee County are upwards of $400 per person. Well, I would argue that our challenges not only are just as equal, but just as important and deserving of funding as any other part of the state. So I'm excited about it. Both houses are talking about it. The governor put a form of it in his budget. And so the fact that all parties are having this discussion is a really good sign. And it's, we're in a spot where we haven't been before. And so I'm pretty hopeful.
All right. I'm not going to dash that hope. So we are speaking with Romaine Quinn. He represents the 25th district, stretching from Bayfield to Superior to Rice Lake in the Wisconsin State Senate. He's a member of the Republican Party, which has a majority, but not quite a supermajority in the state legislature. That means working with Democratic Governor Tony Evers, who you just mentioned. How's that going? And have you had your pictures taken together yet?
Well, I would love to if I have the opportunity. So obviously, there's a lot of commonalities. I'll be the first to say that. There's a lot in the governor's proposed spending plan that is very similar to, I think, a lot of our ideas. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of how do we get there? And so I think there are opportunities to work together. And I hope both sides put their best foot forward and see what we can come up with.
Mm-hmm. Any particular policy other than the tax that we just mentioned that of his that you would support?
Obviously, the governor has been a big proponent of education, in particular public education. I sit on the Senate Education Committee. I sat on the committee in the assembly. I understand and recognize the role that public schools play, especially in our rural communities. They really are the hearts of our communities. So it's how do we fund them going forward? So the governor has his idea. There's going to be a whole range of ideas on our side of the aisle, but really trying to find that sweet spot of maybe we can't afford exactly what he's asking for, but we can still make investments in areas I think we all support, special education funding, and trying to alleviate some of the disparities we see. So the high cost of transportation, for instance, how is it fair that we are comparing school report cards when my district might spend twice as much just to get the student to the door mm-hmm. than another district. So the educational opportunities there are just not the same. So how we go about addressing that funding and where we invest it is super important. And I think we'll make some headway there this time as well.
Let's get back to the Superior Days agenda on education. Tuition reciprocity was another point brought up for students who live in Minnesota and go to school in Wisconsin or vice versa. They have different rates, and we used to have the same rate, and that got changed. And then also tax reciprocity for workers who likewise work in one state and live in the other. Do you see that happening?
Well, I hope we can make a little progress there. I had a meeting with Secretary of DOR, Peter Barca, and Peter Barca used to be the minority leader in the assembly. So I've known Peter for quite some time, even before his role. And we had that discussion. He's been talking with his counterpart in Minnesota saying, how can we get there? Mm-hmm. Now, the previous DOR secretary in Minnesota was not inclined to do it. Remember, this kind of started when Wisconsin skipped their payment that we owed Minnesota. Now, we have paid them back, but there's a little bad blood there. But he is hopeful with the new person taking over in Minnesota that they can make that case to the administration, to Governor Walz, to say, hey, this is good for both parties. Let's get back on track and get in a better position for both sides of the river.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, Minnesota's got that $17 billion surplus, so, you know, they can give a little to Wisconsin, right?
Sure.
Why should that not be a priority for us? Sure, let's ask them.
Right.
Going to priorities, what are your biggest priorities, either on the Superior Days agenda or not?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of issues that we can address. And what we find over and over is that you can't just tackle one issue at once. So almost everything we work on in the Capitol is interconnected. So when we talk about affordable housing, workforce housing, the lack of housing, that is a big issue across the state that both houses are looking to invest heavily in, right? And what does that do? It opens up opportunities for population growth, workers in our businesses. So it's economic development, families that can move to northern Wisconsin, buy an affordable home and raise their kids and families here in safe, great communities. And those kids are in our schools and that affects school funding. So again, all these issues that we talk about really have to be addressed at once because they're all related somehow. And so we don't just, at least in my office, we don't just focus on one thing. We're working very hard on trying to move the ball in the right direction on a whole number of fronts across the next session.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned housing, and you are the chair, correct, of the Housing Committee in the Senate?
Yes, I asked to be that, and I was lucky enough to be appointed. And so just last week, we held a hearing. I brought in the Assembly counterparts as well to hear from the Wisconsin Realtors Association, the League of Municipalities, and the Builders Association, and other folks that really have a direct impact on housing to really get our arms around how big of a problem is this, what is causing the problem, and then now that we set that stage, how do we move forward with solutions to expand that? So over the next couple of weeks, there's going to be a big package of bills coming forward addressing all sorts of housing issues, trying to get that development really spurred, especially in rural areas. You know, we know the city of Superior has some of the oldest housing stock in the country. So yes. What challenges does that bring to the table, right? And so it may not just be about new development, but how do we rehab and maintain the houses we currently have? So there's a whole host of issues there, but I'm also, again, excited that we could get some traction on.
Mm-hmm. And how do you balance that, you know, versus a Madison that has entirely different housing issues? Or are they different? I don't know.
Well, that's with every issue, right? I always say if you draw a line across the northern third of the state, there's three or four of us senators that represent basically a third of the state. And there's more senators that represent pieces of Milwaukee County than there are us up here. So really, it's about banding together and making sure that all the resources, all the ideas, all the solutions aren't Madison-based, aren't Milwaukee-based. And we see this across the board, whether it's rural EMS, you know, with ambulance services or volunteer firefighters. We constantly are getting rules imposed on us that make life harder, that just don't make sense for us, as opposed to full-time departments in Milwaukee and Madison. So that's the kind of push and pull we have, whether we talk about housing or any issue, is making sure that what we do actually makes sense for those of us north of Highway 8.
And drilling down, maybe even outside of Superior, in the very rural areas, what are the housing issues? I mean, we all talk about a housing shortage everywhere, and prices certainly are going up all over the place. They haven't come down with, you thought, right, with the interest rates going up. You thought, well, the prices come down. I haven't seen that. So, but is that true in our rural areas?
Yeah, so I'm a realtor as well, and so I see it firsthand. I think the prices are starting to soften, depending mm-hmm. on what kind of housing it is. But there is still a lot of pressure right now, regardless of interest rates, because we know that since the recession in 08 and 09, we have lost a greater number of builders who left the industry that never came back. So we have been producing almost half as many housing units as we did pre-recession. That more than a decade ago. So it's a perfect storm right now of not enough people in the pipeline, not enough talent today that can build the homes. And then we have local governments, right or wrong, that have their own idea of what housing should be that may not match what we need today. So I think we need to really incentivize governments to say, hey, you know, your minimum lot sizes, your restrictions on multi-use housing units. We got to get creative here. So when we have municipalities that require, you know, larger lots that make it difficult to cash flow and to build a workforce housing that a mother and father working at a local job can actually afford, I mean, that's a problem. So there's going to be a whole package of bills coming that.
And you're speaking of like multi-unit buildings or at least houses that are closer together as opposed to La Grande estate that takes up 4 acres or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Or even I look at in my home county of Barron County, we've tried very hard down here to prevent sprawl, to preserve what we have some of the best agricultural land in the country. But in doing that, our zoning rules make it very difficult to build a home. So for an example, I would love to be able to give my parents a couple acres of my land and build close by where they can retire and be close to my kids. But in Barron County, if I want to create a new lot out in the county, I need 19 acres to be able to build. Hmm. Well, that just makes it absolutely impossible for someone who maybe can't afford 19 acres or for someone like me who would like to give a few off to provide a housing opportunity for my own parents. So I think we got to start thinking out of the box. Maybe the rules, the regulations, the zonings, the requirements that we've required in the past, maybe they don't work anymore. Or maybe we should just take a second look to say, even though our intentions were right, are we driving up the cost of housing ourselves? And that's something we need to look at.
All right. We're speaking with Romaine Quinn. He represents the 25th District, stretching from Bayfield to Superior, Rice Lake, and beyond in the Wisconsin State Senate. We are talking about a variety of issues. I want to clarify for myself. I may actually be a bit Superior Duluth-centric when I said that I haven't seen the prices go down, because I think that's a result of remote working, and everybody loves this area, and people from the Twin Cities says, would love to live there, but there's nothing to do. Well, now they can do their work anywhere, and they're buying up our houses up here. So, you know, that's the prices that have not come down. So maybe that'll change. How's the job working out personally? This isn't like Congress, so you don't have to move to Washington, but Madison isn't close either. So how much are you there? How much do you get to go back home? And do you have a crash pad? And can friends stay there?
Yeah. So I try to budget my weeks as Tuesday through Thursdays in the Capitol and then Mondays through Fridays back in the district for opportunities or events that I miss while I'm down in Madison. And so, like, for instance, today after we're off the phone, I'm home for the week, but I have a listening session and I have a meeting with local school districts. And over the weekend, I'll have some events I have to be at on Saturday. So it's not a 9-to-5 job. I don't clock my 40 in and go home and shut my phone off.
Well, you can't with your young son. You're not going to do that anyway. So.
No, exactly. Exactly. But it is a balance. And that's why we've tried to do things in terms of how the job works so that everyone can participate. Because, you know, we've talked about going to a part-time legislature or things like that. But when you do that, you really make it a job only for people that are retired. Because it almost takes someone that owns their own business or that is retired and already is drawing on their own retirement and so on to try to make this work. And so that's why I try to encourage, you know, people with families who are making these decisions to try and run, to try to make the job doable for those of us that maybe have other work or do have young families, and it takes time away. And it's especially difficult for rural legislators. About 2/3 of my colleagues, when we're in session in Madison, they still get to go home every night, and I don't. And so it makes it harder for Angie Sapik, for Chance Green, for myself, for Senator Felskowski and Tomahawk and others, because the commitment we're making is really a lot greater than most legislators in the Capitol today.
All right. Anything about that long drive? We've all been on it. How used to it do you get? Does it ever get better?
I think I could close my eyes and make the trip now, but I'm not going to try it. So well, I don't know if it's Elon Musk or anybody else, but I'm ready for driverless vehicles any day now.
If you introduce the legislation, you might even get a journalistic endorsement. So I've covered that story, so we could talk about that later. All right. We've been speaking with Romaine Quinn. He represents the 25th District in the Wisconsin State Senate. Thank you for joining us, Romaine.
thanks for having me, and I look forward to being back on your show in the future.
Coming up, a longtime news anchor tells news stories as a novelist.
As they watched the baby sleep, she continued to work her mouth, dreaming of consonants and vowels, it seemed. In truth, Esme was quietly trying to regain the muscle control of her mouth while working to bring back the memories of speech.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. If you've turned on a television set any time in the last 3 or 4 decades in the Twin Ports, chances are you saw Barbara Ryles on your screen. She was the longtime anchor, investigative reporter, and ultimately news director for KBJR-TV and its various incarnations and affiliates, who really defined TV news in the region before her retirement in 2017. So what's she doing now? You'd think after writing endless scripts for news reports, she wouldn't want to touch a pen or a keyboard again. But instead, she's been churning out more, including a novel, Dying to Live, and a children's book, Winston's Big Win, both published last year. And she joins me now. Welcome to Simply Superior, Barbara Ryles.
Thanks, Robin. Good to be here.
Or shall I say Barbara McPherson Ryles, because I notice you use your full name for your adult novel, but just Barbara Ryles in the children's book. It's the same person?
Same person. I just spent so long writing my novel, I figured it needed 3 names.
It didn't have enough words already?
It's funny that, you know, I included my maiden name, and as I look back on my career that you talked about there so nicely, so kindly, I wish in the beginning I'd used my maiden name, McPherson, on the air rather than my married name, Ryles, just so that I could have had a little separation of me and the TV person.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyway, I decided to include it in my novel just because.
Okay. Well, also, I'm thinking McPherson is to accentuate your Scottish heritage, if I'm correct about that, or maybe your Canadian one. So tell me about those.
Yeah, I'm almost 100% Scottish. I had my DNA done by one of those genetic things, 23andMe, and it came back with a little note that said they seldom see someone who is so close to 100% of one nationality. And I was 99.6% Scottish. And the 0.4% was Scandinavian. And of course, I go back in my family's history, and it probably is due to the Viking invasion that I have some Scandinavian, some Viking blood in me,
mm-hmm.
but mostly Scottish blood.
Via Canada, too.
Via Canada. I grew up in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, and moved to Saskatoon when I started university at the University of Saskatchewan, and met my husband, who was living in Canada but had been born in the United States. And when we got married, and he got a scholarship, he was just starting college at the time, he got a scholarship to come to Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. And we got married and moved together, and have lived in the United States consistently since then. Have lived in Minnesota consistently since then.
Mm-hmm. We are speaking with Barbara Ryles, or Barbara McPherson Ryles, if you prefer. She's the longtime KBJR anchor turned novelist in her retirement, which means she really isn't retired. So rather than talking about the books, let's hear a selection from one. Which would you like to share first?
I'll read a little bit from Winston's Big Win. I have to tell you that Winston's Big Win is about a little boy who has uncontrolled flatulence, and he ends up being a hero because of this flatulence. So let me find a little place where it talks about what happened with Winston. One day, Winston was walking home from school and saw a group of people gathered around a deep hole in the ground. Winston wandered over to see what was going on. To his shock, he saw a little girl and a puppy had fallen into the deep hole and were trapped in the mud. The sides were so slippery that the little girl couldn't climb out with her puppy. The fire department had been called, but in the meantime, the poor little girl was very frightened. Without thinking, Winston jumped into the deep ditch, landing in mud that came up to his knees. He quickly scooped up the little girl and her puppy, holding them tightly, but then realized he had no way out. As Winston stood still, shivering and thinking, he suddenly passed an enormous blast of gas. So great was the wind that it blew all of them right up and out of the ditch. Everyone clapped as the tiny girl gave Winston a huge hug. So there's the kind of thing that Winston did with his flatulence, which, of course, came at exactly the moment he needed it. In another passage, he saves a little boy, a little boy who is stuck in a burning building way up in the top levels. And the fire department has a net for him to jump into, but the little boy's too frightened. But Winston, once again, blasts the gas that catapults him up, and then he jumps down into the safety net with the little boy and saves him. So,
you know, there was a time that you probably couldn't write about such an incident, or an attribute, I should say.
Right, exactly.
But those times have gone, and we're talking about all kinds of things quite seriously that we didn't before. I wouldn't say for better or for worse. I would say for better. I mean, you're almost going to get me making political comments about places where you can't talk about certain things in children's books.
Certain bodily functions are not allowed.
Well, bodily functions or history or whatever. Okay.
Even history. You're right. You're absolutely right.
So did you have a publisher who, you know, expressed an opinion one way or the other or said this exactly what we're looking for?
My publisher is Atmosphere Press. And
that's appropriate right there.
Remember, my other book isn't about flatulence. It's
about
reincarnation.
We'll get to that in a second. Right. Yes. Go ahead. Yep.
But yes, they accepted, first of all, my novel. And I was assigned an editor. And, you know, like every writer, I was annoyed with the editor, but made the changes, as suggested and recommended. And my book was better for it. As most writers will say, afterwards, the product was better. It's during the process that they're like, grr. But you know that as an editor yourself.
That is my adage, that everyone needs an editor, including editors.
There you go. So yes, an Atmosphere was absolutely wonderful to me. When they published my first book, Dying to Live, about reincarnation, they encouraged me and are still encouraging me to get going on a sequel to Dying to Live. The person in my book who is the one who is reincarnated is the hero, and she ends up being born again. And she was a medical scientist in a past life and actually won a Nobel Prize and for medical science. And when she's born again, she, as a baby, has entire memory of her past life. And so during the book, she builds on the skills that she already has as a doctor, a scientist, and a researcher. And once again, towards the end of this novel, wins a Nobel Prize for a different process, a different thing that she has discovered, invented, created. So my publisher said, you've got this protagonist. Why not take her and have her? She dies at the end of Dying to Live.
Oh, don't give it away. It's about reincarnation. So maybe
not the end. So that's not the end. That's what my publisher says. Take it again. Have her born again. And so I am working on a sequel.
Born again in the literal sense, not necessarily the religious sense.
But. Right. No, actually. And when I think about my title, I think that there are probably people who think it is a religious book, but I stay completely away from any religious connotations at all in this book. So it just wasn't part of my story that came out of my head. Mm-hmm. Interesting process for writing. For me, I sat down at the keyboard, started with a basic premise, and then the story just sort of came out of my fingers as I sat at my keyboard. And I was left wondering when I took a break at the end of my writing session, what was going to happen with my characters in my book, because I didn't know until I sat down and they began to tell me what was happening. So it's an interesting process.
It's also interesting that you have one publisher who would publish both an adult occult novel, I see one reference to it, and a children's book. Is that unusual? Well, I think it's unusual.
It is unusual, but my publisher, in encouraging me to write a sequel to Dying to Live, said that they would take my children's book and publish it as well. So it was sort of a nod to, if you do this, we'll do this. So, yeah.
No reason to argue with them about that.
All right.
Well, let's hear a selection from Dying to Live.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you a little bit more. The scientist's name is Esther, and she is very confused when she wakes up as a newborn baby. Instead of the senior citizen she was as her last known memory. She was in an assisted living facility and went to sleep and woke up as a newborn baby, and all her memories from her past life are completely intact, even though she is now physically an infant. The new infant is named Esme Montgomery, and she looks at that and says, "Esther, Esme, I guess it kind of makes sense," and just accepts it. Her interaction with her parents are not like a normal baby because her intellectual abilities are so incredible. I mean, she is walking by the time she's about 4 days old. You know, it's a sort of a gradual learning process as she remembers how to talk. And so here is when Esme had been trying to talk to her parents, and at first they didn't understand it. And then they realized that what this newborn baby was doing was trying to communicate with them. And the baby worked at it so long that she was just exhausted, because even though she had the intellect of an adult, she had the body of a child, a baby. So here it is. This is chapter 7. As they watched the baby sleep, she continued to work her mouth, dreaming of consonants and vowels, it seemed. In truth, Esme was quietly trying to regain the muscle control of her mouth while working to bring back the memories of speech. This continued for more than 2 hours. Steve and Lori, that's her parents, were mesmerized. When Esme finally opened her eyes, the first thing she did was say, "I hungry." The R's were particularly difficult without teeth, but the meaning was clear. Lori didn't speak or look at Steve. She just began nursing her baby in silence. Steve sat and watched, stunned by the developments. By the time she'd eaten, Esme had regained her confidence. She knew she sounded like a baby, but she knew she had to let her parents know she wasn't an ordinary child. She could make her meaning clear for the most part. At this point, she didn't know how much of the truth her parents could handle, but she wanted Lori and Steve to know that she wasn't what she seemed. She wanted them to understand that she could speak, though not well, without teeth. Finally, Esme lifted her head from nursing and spoke again, this time in a much clearer fashion. "I sorry to startle you, ma and da. We need to talk. I'm as confused as you are about this whole thing. I'm fine, Willie. I'm okay. I seem to be a baby. You're a baby, but I'm really an old lady, a woman, an old scientist, actually. You see, the last thing I remember is falling asleep. Something must have happened. I guess I must have died. I seem to have re-emerged as you infant." So there's a little selection from the book.
All right. We are speaking with Barbara McPherson-Riles, the author of Dying to Live, a book about reincarnation. And although I don't want to make things about me, you know, it kind of reminds me of an interesting childhood memory that I will relate one of these days if I ever write my autobiography, if anyone's interested.
You need to write it. You need to write it.
But the early memory is quite seriously. I used to follow a cat around our house. We had a very large domestic cat named Katha, after Katha Kowitz, the artist. And Katha was quite prolific. She had 9 kittens at one point.
Oh, my.
And I thought I was one of them. And I can distinctly remember crawling on all fours behind Katha. And then one day, looking at Katha and seeing these 2 legs and looking up at the legs and looking at this human being who kind of looked at me, and I kind of looked at myself and looked at her, and, oh, that's my mother, not Katha. And I remember standing up, running to my room, crying, saying, I'm not a cat.
For goodness sakes. Right. Well, maybe it was the cat there when you were born.
There's a second part to it.
Okay.
So, you know, this has got to be family folklore. And my mother said, actually, I don't remember you saying that, but I do remember that incident because that was the first time you walked.
Oh, wow.
So what I apparently said, and, you know, now I'm going to check the, do you walk before you talk? I have to check that out. But quite seriously, I'm sure I said that because that's my memory. It wouldn't be made up.
Right.
And what I probably said was, bobbly bobbles boo boo. In other words, I said something exactly as you just described, right?
Yeah, right.
A child trying to make a sound, trying to communicate, trying to make words, and regardless of how they come out, that is what the child was saying. So, you know what?
Yeah.
You know how
right.
novels yeah. are supposed to take away something and your own personal, you just did it
right?
with me, right?
Excellent. Yeah. Now you have to buy the book. See?
There you go.
That's what
right.
happens. Right. you probably imprinted on that mother cat, you know, and then when you realize that you had two legs, not four, that's when you realize, oh, I guess I can walk. I don't have to go around on four digits.
Boy, you know, you just saved me thousands on therapy there. So.
There you go.
And no problem with toilet training. I was very good at that, I think. So
very good. You didn't use the kitty litter box.
Well, all right. You already wrote about flatulence. We don't have to go there.
Right.
We are speaking with Barbara Riles, the author. Yes, Barbara Riles, the retired TV anchor. So going from TV writing to novels, let alone children's books, what translates and what doesn't translate? You know, do you have trouble keeping from falling into news writing when you're trying to tell these stories? Or have you found a new voice? Or tell me.
Well, one of the first things my publisher said to me when he read my manuscript was, this is written like a TV news report. You know, like I'm used to having the visual part tell mm-hmm. a story. And my editor said, you've got to describe the scenes better. You've got to take the time to put people in the picture. And that was the first time I realized that as I went back and looked at my initial draft, that I had written it like a reporter, like a news story. And so I went back and did my best, but I still garnered some criticism from critiques from people who say I write like a reporter without enough description, without enough personal feeling attached to my characters and so on. So that is something I am working on as I work on my sequel. I'm working on making it more of a descriptive novel, a novel where I'm actually putting in, giving my characters opinions and personal feelings. So, you know, I'm doing my best to listen to my editors. You'll be happy to know.
Mm-hmm. Any chance you might marry your endeavors together and give us a TV version of your books? You know, we have Chris Monroe's Monkey with the Tool Belts have been successfully adapted into a Netflix series.
I would absolutely love that. And one of the good things about having a publisher is that they get it out in front of these people who write book critiques. And, mm-hmm. And a couple of them said that my Dying to Live novel would translate very well to the screen, big or small. So who knows? Maybe.
Netflix, we're looking at you.
right. But I don't know much about writing a screenplay. And so I have to think about and do some research on how that's done.
I think the most important thing is having the story going again to Chris Monroe. She's been on the show and she actually did not write the screenplays. And she said they saw the books, they loved them. And they said, we'll take over from here. And she actually doesn't interfere. So
that's what I needed somebody to buy it. I don't know that I'm as talented as Chris Monroe. Do you know, I was the subject of a Chris Monroe cartoon in the Duluth News Tribune at one point. It was a Christmas City of the North parade earlier in my career, quite early. And I was on the street interviewing, you know, Santa Claus and all of the very important interviews that you do during the Christmas City parade. But I was talking to some people who had miniature horses. They were absolutely adorable. But all of a sudden, one of those miniature horses came up behind me and took a solid chomp of my rear end. And I jumped and said, "That horse just bit my backside." And so Chris Monroe drew a picture of me with a microphone in my hand standing on the street with a horse chomping on my backside. She thought it was hilarious. I was just pleased to be a part of a Chris Monroe cartoon in the paper.
I can't think of a better honor than that, except for writing a couple books, Winston's Big Win and Dying to Live, both written by Barbara McPherson Riles. Well, maybe one written by Barbara Riles.
Too much for my kids.
Thank you for joining us, Barbara.
My pleasure, Rob, at any time.
Coming up, the regional news in review. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and we're joined by Rick Lubbers of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
We also have a report from WPR News Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading on a push to increase electric vehicle charging stations in our region. Here's Danny's report.
Pop in there.
George Bousset is already sold on electric vehicles. On a gray winter day, he heads out on the snow-covered streets of Bayfield in his 2021 Chevy Bolt. Bousset, who lives just south of Ashland, says he's already put about 17,000 miles on the car since he and his wife bought it 2 years ago.
I just love this car. This is the favorite car of all the cars I've had, and I'm 74 years old, going all the way back to a 1957 Cadillac.
Electric vehicles are still pretty rare in Wisconsin, but that's changing. Last year, the state registered nearly 14,000 of them, an increase of more than 53% from 2021. And now it may be less costly for others who want to buy. The Federal Inflation Reduction Act, passed in 2022, allows eligible buyers up to a $4,000 tax credit for a used EV and up to $7,500 for a new one. The credits come with complex requirements, though, and not all EVs will qualify. Bousset says his Bolt can go up to 250 miles on a full charge. That's plenty for his day-to-day use, but the availability of charging stations on long road trips is still a concern. Francisco Sayu is Emerging Technology Director of Renew Wisconsin.
People saying, like, you know, I want to buy an EV, but it's really hard to go anywhere with one. So it's keeping people away.
Jeremiah Brockman is president of the recently created Wisconsin chapter of the Electric Vehicle Association. He says the availability of charging stations is about to get a lot better.
If you're in the market for a new car, you should definitely consider an electric one. But if you do a lot of road trips, you might want to wait 2 to 5 years.
Wisconsin is preparing to build roughly 60 fast charging stations. The state is receiving nearly $79 million through the bipartisan infrastructure law to install them. Caleb Vanderweel with the Wisconsin Department of Transportation says chargers will be placed every 50 miles on designated roadways and within a mile of exits. He says those would include major routes in northern Wisconsin.
We're hopeful that at the end of the day, if you have an electric vehicle and you live in one of the southern metro areas of the state, that you'll really have that comfort in knowing that if you're going to the Northwoods, that you have somewhere to charge along the way.
As automakers ramp up production of EVs, they're still facing supply chain challenges. And in Wisconsin, there's an additional challenge due to the way the state regulates electricity sales. The federal law requires stations built with federal funds to charge a rate for electricity sold. In Wisconsin, only regulated utilities are allowed to sell electricity to the public. Governor Tony Evers' budget would allow companies to sell electricity at charging stations without being regulated like a utility. Some GOP lawmakers, like Green Bay Republican Senator Rob Coles, say that change is necessary.
We're not going to get the build out that I think we deserve because these electric cars are coming. You know, whether you like them or not, the citizens buy them and they want to be able to charge them up. And we're going to be an outlier within the Midwest if we don't do this.
George Bousset and his brother Bill are drinking lattes at a Bayfield coffee shop. Bill and his wife are weighing whether to buy an electric vehicle. He says federal tax incentives certainly play a role.
You know, this is a major financial decision for us, and range is certainly a consideration.
Bill says they'd like an EV for both short and long road trips to visit family. They're planning to buy in a year or two. By then, he hopes the state and the nation will have made great strides in building a network of EV charging stations.
And that was WPR News Superior-based reporter Danielle Kading. So, Rick, last week we talked about the roof collapse at Miller Hill Mall. What's the timetable for getting back to normal?
Well, it's fairly soon here. It's already underway, actually. Less than a week after a section of its roof caved in under the weight of snow, the Miller Hill Mall is starting to get back to business. A seven-phase reopening plan began Sunday when 10 tenants along the mall's northern edge got the go-ahead to return to their premises. Before the mall can allow tenants to return to a given section, it needs a go-ahead from city inspectors who double-check the fire alarms and other life safety systems and making sure that they're functioning properly. Mall staff are also required to complete a structural analysis of the roof, report corrective measures to the city, as well as reinforce the area around the collapsed roof and remove snow and other debris from it. A statement from the Miller Hill Mall encouraged shoppers to visit retailer websites and social media accounts for information on their reopening status. Essentia Health, which hosts several services at the mall, reopened its Center for Personal Fitness on Saturday and its Miller Hill Surgery Center and Pharmacy on Wednesday. No Essentia properties were damaged by the collapse, but its facilities have gradually reopened over the last week as structural inspections were made and all patient appointments have resumed as scheduled.
So was the entire mall shut? Because I know like JCPenney was pretty far away from where the roof collapse happened.
Yeah, it was originally vacated the entire premises for a time while engineers and city folks took a look at the roof. And then it has since gradually reopened various sections of the mall.
Okay. Well, heavy snows aren't just causing a problem at area rooftops. It's making fishing more difficult than usual.
Yes, it's probably going to take snowshoes, maybe even a saw and a lot of huffing and puffing to reach your fishing hole on the Brewer River tomorrow, which is opening day of steelhead trout season. It's also the earliest possible opening date because it's always held the last Saturday in March. And this year, that is the 25th. So it comes on a very snowy winter as it's dragging on with 3 feet of snow or more still on the ground in parts of the area. The good news is that most of the river's ice gave way from U.S. Highway 2 to downstream of County Road FF more than a week ago. Whether it opens up all the way to the lake by the opening day, allowing fresh fish from Lake Superior to swim upstream, that remains uncertain. It's not just the deep snow that will slow anglers from getting to the river, though. It's also trees that were down in the heavy, wet mid-December snowstorm. Some trees are bent, others are broken, and they're blocking some trails up and down the river. Opening day in the river usually draws crowds as the Northland's first big open water fishing of the year. And that will come a half hour before sunrise when trout and salmon become legal game downstream of U.S. Highway 2. Snow may crust over during colder overnight temperatures, allowing walking on top of it, but then soften as daytime high temperatures rise well above freezing. Snowshoes might be a necessary option to reach some of the areas.
Okay. Lastly, the University of Wisconsin's Badgers won the women's Frozen Four College Hockey Tournament held at Duluth Amsoil Arena last week. Congrats are due to them. There's also reason to cheer for the University of Minnesota Duluth women's basketball team.
Yes, there is. UMD has enjoyed the best of March Madness, and it will now conclude in April. The Bulldogs advance to next week's NCAA Division II National Championship by defeating Catawba College 70-59 Wednesday night in St. Joseph, Missouri. Minnesota Duluth fifth-year senior Brooke Olson led all scorers with 34 points in the NCAA Elite Eight semifinal victory at St. Joseph's Civic Arena, which earned the Bulldogs a trip to the national championship game on April 1 in Dallas. Celebrating, Olson said, "No one's ever done this in UMD history. So I'm really excited to keep making history and hopefully make some more and just relish the moment as much as we can." The Bulldogs will face number one ranked Ashland University, the one in Ohio, at American Airlines Center in search of the program's first national championship. The weekend in Dallas will celebrate the 50th anniversary of the implementation of Title IX by staging all three women's NCAA championship games at the same site.
All right. We've been joined by Rick Lubbers, executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
You can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. Ezra Wall is our executive producer. We received production assistance from Kate Spranger, and our theme song was written and performed by Bruce Nelson. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Superior point of view, gathered to mirror your life and interest with the goal of helping you to understand the world we live in and the region we hold dear by sharing the stories and information.